Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ken Rudin.
And I'm Don Gagne. Ron Elving is off rediscovering his roots in Sweden this week.
Actually, that's what he wants you to think. First of all, his name is not Ron Elving. He is one of those Russian spies. Matter of fact, he will be visiting St. Petersburg, Russia. Coincidence? I think not. Yeah. Anyway, so Ron is gone. We have Don Gagne here, who knows a thing or two about politics. And I guess we'll end the podcast with, on a sad note, talking about Robert Byrd. But we'll start the week on the riveting confirmation hearings of Elena Kagan.
I have to confess that I'm not always fully engaged in Senate confirmation hearings of Supreme Court justices, especially over the past 15 years or so. I mean, maybe since the Clarence Thomas hearings, because they always take on a certain kind of blandness where the answers are as vague and as general and as non-revealing as
well. You know
why?
The guide was, of course, Robert Bork, who gave specific answers, and every answer upset everybody who was listening. He said, wait a second, this guy should not be confirmed to the Supreme Court. Every subsequent Supreme Court nominee has been very, very careful with his or her answers.
So for every justice or future justice since then, it seemed a lot like they were in the dentist chair or something. But Kagan, she seemed to love this. She didn't reveal a great deal more in terms of what kind of justice she will be. But I think she revealed a great deal about herself that none of us really knew about her. And I found it, if not entertaining, charming. And you could see her approach kind of having an effect on the senators on the panel.
I guess the only question is how many Republicans or how many senators vote against her. There were 31 no votes on Sotomayor. There were 22 on John Roberts. 42 votes against Samuel Alito, including Senator Obama voted against both Roberts and Alito. As a matter of fact, was part of the failed filibuster against Alito. So I assume it's 30-some-odd, between 30 and 35 senators voting no. That would be my guess. Doesn't it seem, though, that this is just practice? I mean, look, we're having Sonia Sotomayor replace David Souter. We're having Elena Kagan replace John Paul Stevens. Ideologically, there's no change there. But if an Anthony Kennedy would leave or a conservative would leave while President Obama is still president, I mean, that's all hell would break loose.
You're right. Nobody feels like they're giving anything up. In fact, some of the loudest complaints we're hearing are from progressive groups who say, hey, she's not liberal enough.
We really don't know what her philosophy is, except I thought it was a little forthcoming for her to concede, yes, I am a progressive. Otherwise, what else would I be doing in the Clinton administration and the Obama administration? I clerk for Abner Mikva. I clerk for Thurgood Marshall. By the way, speaking of Thurgood Marshall, I think the real question is not whether Elena Kagan will be confirmed, but whether Thurgood Marshall will be confirmed. He somehow seemed to be the issue on the opening day of the hearings.
Well, and that was a very fascinating line of attack. It did show how little they had to go after her with. But I think a lot of us were surprised the degree to which the Republicans tried to make Thurgood Marshall an issue. And maybe they're counting on people kind of forgetting who Thurgood Marshall was, forgetting what his legacy is. But we did see that line of questioning essentially stop after the first day. And truth be told, it was mostly in the opening statements. But if you know a nominee is going to be confirmed, and I don't think there are any real doubts here, shouldn't the opposition, the Republicans' approach be do no harm to themselves?
That's a fair question because, you know, when, for example, Rand Paul, the Kentucky Senate nominee, did this weird thing against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, there were so many Republicans who, you know, held their head and said, why do we have to bring up this issue again? So the nation's first African-American Supreme Court Justice, Thurgood Marshall, for the Republicans to use that attack line, you wonder what the priorities are, whether you want to look forward or go back there. And in a week that we know that Elena Kagan will be confirmed, in a week that somehow we're bringing up the legacy of Thurgood Marshall, we should also remember that one of the senators who voted against Thurgood Marshall back in 1967, one of the 11 senators who voted against him, and as a matter of fact wrote to J. Edgar Hoover wondering about his communist connections, was Robert Byrd, who we're also celebrating or commemorating this week. And if nothing else, it just shows that Robert Byrd was a quite complicated and fascinating character in his 50-plus years in Congress.
Barack Obama, when he was a new senator, one of the first things he did when he came to Washington was meet with Robert Byrd. And Senator Byrd presented him with a signed copy of his History of the Senate. And they talked a little bit about the sweep of Byrd's career. And Byrd acknowledged to Barack Obama some regrets from his early day. And this is in the president's Audacity of Hope book. And his response, according to his book, was essentially that we all have things from our youth that we have moved beyond, that we have regrets, and that we've learned from.
And we'll get to Byrd later in the podcast. It's hard to not talk about Byrd throughout, but after the West Virginia primary, where Hillary Clinton soundly defeated Barack Obama, Robert Byrd weighed in with a critical endorsement of Obama over Clinton. Okay, but before we get to that, assuming that Elena Kagan will be easily confirmed, I think General Petraeus looked like he was easily confirmed this week as well.
99-0. Yeah. His hearing coming after all of the drama of soon-to-be-retired general, four-star general McChrystal and the Rolling Stone interview and all of that, was kind of one of those boring Senate hearings. The moments of it I saw. The interesting question was Petraeus and that planned July 2011, 1 year from now, beginning of
the withdrawal. Date of the withdrawal.
And it's been portrayed as a deadline, and the president says it's not a deadline, but it is a target. And Petraeus, who we have learned over the past 9 months or so that he has never been comfortable with that date. But in talking to the Senate panel this week, he said those key words, based on conditions on the ground. So that's the thing that will provide any kind of wiggle room from that date. But he did seem to say it is something that we should be hoping for, again, if.
Well, he has to say that because this is President Obama's war policy. This is not just like it wasn't General McChrystal's war policy. It's not General Petraeus's war policy. It's the Obama administration, and they have said over and over again that, of course, conditions on the ground, understanding that they want to begin a phased pullout beginning in the summer of 2011. That is not good news for John McCain, who insists that that's just nuts. But many Democrats ask the same question over and over again to Petraeus in different words, but do you stand by the president's policy? And over and over again, Petraeus, who is very smart politically, unlike McChrystal, who clearly was not smart politically, and he said, no, I'm with the president 100%.
And now we watch him. He is, of course, best known for the successes he had in Iraq. Afghanistan is different from Iraq. He does not have the deep experience in Afghanistan. So Petraeus even, it's funny to say it now, but he's on a learning curve. And it's a difficult situation, obviously, but we'll have to see how his previous successes apply here.
Basically, General Petraeus is a guy who's going to have to save President Obama's war policy in Afghanistan. And yet not long ago, those of us with long memories or even short memories, remember he was the MoveOn.org target in General Betrayus, that, you know, the left hated him because of Iraq and the surge and all these things. And Senator Obama in 2007 was also laying into Petraeus on the war policy and things like that.
This continues to be a disastrous foreign policy mistake. And we are now confronted with the question, how do we clean up the mess and make the best out of a situation in which there are no good options?
Also, not all that long ago, Petraeus was mentioned as a potential presidential candidate, a challenger to Barack Obama in 2012, but he has knocked that down, says he's not interested.
Speaking of MoveOn.org, there was another thing in the progressive Netroots that happened this week, the Daily Kos. Their founder basically denouncing and trashing the Research 2000 polling firm that they've used for years with some success and finding out that basically everything was fraudulent.
And I think the polls we're talking about specifically here are essentially 2009, starting in January 2009 polls. But Daily Kos, with the prominent role that it plays in the blogosphere, in the interwebs, their polls help create the narrative of a campaign. I mean, they're not obviously the only thing, but the polling that has been posted on Daily Kos has been something that has been looked to.
Perfect example is the Arkansas Democratic Senate race between Blanche Lincoln and Bill Halter. It was the Daily Kos / Research 2000 poll that showed Halter with a lead, basically, in the Democratic runoff in Arkansas. And I think Kos, I mean, was embarrassed, but more angry than anything else, that their reputation was sullied by this poll.
And I guess just to kind of fill in what happened, apparently Research 2000 had financial troubles. They had promised to provide detailed internal data from the raw data
to their own clients.
To their own client, and it wasn't coming. It's like, oh, our computers are down, or they're not returning phone calls.
Dog ate the homework.
Exactly. And ultimately, they were called on it. So what's this mean for Daily Kos?
Well, you also wonder what it does to the larger question about state polls. A lot of people have been very wary about these polling companies that every 5 minutes has a new poll out about a Senate race here, a gubernatorial race here. And it's very expensive to conduct a thorough poll. And a lot of these companies just have a new poll every 5 minutes. So you wonder, there's always a question about the reliability of polls. And this gives the questioners a little more ammunition.
And as you get to state polls, the sample is smaller. We're less likely to know the pollster. We're less likely to know the methodology. And it's not that we're quoting these polls all the time in our coverage, but we do keep an eye on them. We look in a place like Ohio. Is the race narrowing? Hotly contested gubernatorial and Senate races there. And this does kind of give you pause as you start collecting data for any given story we're working on.
Speaking of Ohio, there are new Quinnipiac polls that shows the gubernatorial race, Governor Ted Strickland with about a 5-point lead over John Kasich. It's good news for the Democrats because, you know, obviously a very tough race, but not good news for the Democrats in the sense that Strickland is still at like 43%. And when an incumbent is running under 50%, they're a little nervous about that. Senate race, very, very close. Lee Fisher and Rob Portman.
I think Fisher, the lieutenant governor.
Right, and Rob Portman, the former congressman and Bush trade czar, down by 2 points to Fisher, basically a neck-and-neck race. One poll that I'm very interested in, what's going on in Colorado, is that most polls I've seen show that the appointed Democratic senator there, Michael Bennett, has a sizable lead over Andrew Romanoff, who's the former Speaker of the House, who desperately wanted the appointment when Ken Salazar became Interior Secretary, but the governor named Bennett. The White House is solidly behind Bennett, the Democratic Senate Campaign Committee, solidly behind Bennett, but one dissension, notable dissension this week.
Bill Clinton, the former president, has endorsed the challenger. So it's the first time we have President Clinton making one endorsement and President Obama making another in a Democratic primary race. And the fact that it's a Senate race makes it even more significant.
Right. We saw Clinton and Obama on the same page in Pennsylvania's 12th district. But Barack Obama couldn't campaign in Pennsylvania 12. He's not popular there. Bill Clinton was very popular there, made a big difference for Mark Gritz. And you were covering that race in Arkansas. While President Obama gave a strong endorsement of Blanche Lincoln, Bill Clinton, coming from Arkansas, was a big draw for Lincoln in that runoff primary, and he did very well there. So there is a lot of people trying to say, this is Clinton versus Obama all over again. What ultimately seems to be the case here is that Andrew Romanoff endorsed Hillary Clinton for president in 2008.
Endorsed her in 2007.
Right.
He was an early endorser.
Right. And Michael Bennett was an Obama person, and Bill Clinton basically was thanking an old friend because he's not going to raise funds for Romanoff. He's not going to campaign for him. Apparently, all it is that email endorsement. But still, you know, a lot of people in the Washington establishment, their eyes lit up when they saw, oh, my goodness, it's Bill Clinton versus Barack Obama.
And I'll tell you, I think some eyes lit up in the White House as well. The White House did not get a heads up on this. They found out when we found out, they said. But they downplayed it. They said, you can talk about a big riff. He says, this is two people having a difference of opinion in a primary, nothing else. So nobody's building this up at all. At least none of the inside players are building it up. We are.
Another Senate race that we're all watching is what's going on in Nevada. Harry Reid has been in big trouble from the beginning. He's just not liked. He's never been a likable kind of guy. But he did seem to get the kind of Republican nominee that suits his purposes. Sharon Engel, who has had very controversial and very conservative statements backed by the Tea Party. Seemed like Harry Reid did everything he can behind the scenes to make sure that Engel was the Republican nominee. And now Sharon Engel, who's been avoiding the press for much of the time since she won the nomination, had her first interview, and she sounded like she moderated some of her previous positions.
Our Ina Jaffe did a piece on her this week where she noted that every story since Engel won the primary includes this line. Sharon Engel was not available to be interviewed for this story.
Refused comment.
But she went on the big Nevada political television talk show, hosted by
John Ralston.
And this was not an easy interview for her. He is a tough, combative interviewer, and he went at her on point after point after point, from her talking about we need a Second Amendment remedy to some of the problems we're seeing in Washington, to her call to privatize Social Security, even after all the troubles Wall Street has had and everything else. And basically, she attempted to walk back somewhat some of those positions that have already been featured in Harry Reid ads and in ads by outside groups, really portraying her as a Tea Party extremist.
Harry Reid seeking his fifth term, but I want to end the podcast with a remembrance of somebody who served 9 terms. Robert C. Byrd served in the Senate longer than anybody in history, elected to the Senate in 1958 after 6 years in the House, so he had the longest combined tenure as well. And he was a man of contradictions, shall we say.
Absolutely. I mean, certainly at 92 years of age, he became one of those figures in the Senate that people were just in awe of his stature, of his length of service, of his intellectual gifts. But early in his life, he was a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and you could look at some of his writings, some of his letters back then, and they're shocking to read today. His intolerance and just the out-and-out racism. But
wait, before you do the but, though, because it's not even just the Klan years, even 12 years into the Senate, he filibustered the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. He voted against Thurgood Marshall. He had, you know, strong views on race. But something happened to him. He realized he wanted to be part of the National Democratic Party, and the only way to do that was to renounce his racist past.
And he did. And if you look at his career from that point forward, he did become a champion of civil rights issues. And he earned the admiration of, as we spoke earlier, a new young senator, Barack Obama, and others in the Senate. So you do have to view the man's life in its totality. But it was a very complicated journey indeed.
He is, as we speak, he is lying in repose in the Senate gallery. I guess the difference between lying in repose and lying in state is when lying in state is you're at the Capitol Rotunda. And, of course, there are just senators who just are lying. There's still some debate over whether there will be an election in 2010 or 2012 to replace him. Governor Joe Manchin, who's very, very popular. Manchin wants the seat. He will not appoint himself. It looks like he's going to appoint Nick Casey, who's the former Democratic state chairman.
And we know he's term limited, so he will not
Joe Manchin is, right. Joe,
so he will not be seeking re-election to the governor's.
In 2012, right. So, but the thing is a possibility that the election may be this year, but it looks like either way, there will be a caretaker senator. And again, it's supposed to be Nick Casey, the former Democratic state chair. And then Manchin will run for the seat, whether it's 2010 or 2012. West Virginia has not elected a Republican to the Senate since 1956. You know, even though Republican presidents have been winning West Virginia. But anyway, so it looks like that the Republicans will remain shut out in West Virginia, at least in the Senate race.
On the notion of Manchin's appointee, and you described it as
a caretaker. Right.
Why not just appoint himself? I mean, if he's probably going to run for it in 2 years, he's popular, he's going to be seen as the front runner. And even if it's seen as vanity or too bold of a political move, a self-serving move, why not just do that?
Because the history of governors who appoint themselves to a vacant Senate seat is abysmal. Time and time again, they get rejected at the next opportunity by the voters. It just backfires on them. But it hasn't been going so well for the appointees this year, too.
The caretakers.
Charlie Crist didn't want to appoint himself to the Senate, so he named his top aide George Lemieux, who nobody ever heard of.
Which would then allow Crist to waltz into office.
Well, that's not happening. At least he's not happening as a Republican. I mean, he may win the Senate, but not as a Republican. We saw what happened in Illinois when Rod Blagojevich tried to sell Barack Obama's vacant Senate seat to the highest bidder. He got Roland Burris, the hapless Roland Burris, and now there's a Blagojevich trial that could endanger Democratic control of that seat. We saw in Delaware, we saw Joe Biden help engineer the appointment of his top aide, Ted Kaufman, to that Senate seat, assuming that Biden's son, Beau Biden, would run for the Senate seat in 2010. Beau Biden is not running for that, and it looks like the Republicans will take that seat as well.
And then the safest one of all, Massachusetts.
Right. Well, exactly. Of course, Democrats could have had an appointment, but they changed the law years ago when Mitt Romney was governor. They took the appointment out of his hands. Had they kept that, they would have perhaps still had that seat, and they wouldn't have had some guy named Scott Brown as a senator. So perhaps in the West Virginia situation, it will not backfire on the incumbent party as it has in Delaware, in Florida, in Illinois, states like that, Massachusetts. Joe Manchin retains popularity. It looks like he will keep that seat. He may be more conservative than Robert Byrd was, but he'll still keep it in Democratic hands. And they definitely need that vote.
And of course, as we talk about the politics of it all, which are fascinating, this is a day, a week, when the people of West Virginia are really thinking about their late senator, Robert Byrd.
And that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ken Rudin.
And I am Don Gonde.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR. Ron Elving will still be at the Kremlin. Country roads, take me home to the place.
God Almighty, Sears Roebuck, Carter's Little Liver Pills, and Robert C. Byrd, and not necessarily in that order.